from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, Apple's defiance of a court order to help the FBI unlock an iPhone continues to draw strong reaction. The phone was used by one of the attackers in the San Bernardino mass killing last December, and the feds say it could have information on other would-be attackers or future plots. But Apple says to comply with the court would be to threaten the privacy of all its customers. It's a legal showdown that many in Silicon Valley say has been brewing for years. We talk about its implications for personal privacy and national security next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. 2.5 months ago, 14 people were killed in an attack at the Inland Regional Center in San Bernardino. In the investigation, federal authorities obtained an iPhone used by one of the attackers, but were unable to break into it because of some of the phone's security features. The FBI asked Apple for help, but Apple refused. Then this week, a California judge ordered the Cupertino company to cooperate. Apple has again refused. So where does that leave us, and what's at stake if Apple gives federal investigators the assistance they're after? We take up all this and your questions in this hour of Forum. Joining me are Nate Cardozo. He's an attorney for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Good morning, Nate Cardozo.
Good morning.
Also joining me is Benjamin Wittes. He's a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution and co-director of the Harvard Law School Brookings Project on Law and Security. He's also editor-in-chief of the Lawfare blog, which is devoted to discussion of hard national security choices. Good morning, Benjamin Wittes.
Thanks for having me.
And also joining me is Laura Seidel. She's the digital cultural correspondent for National Public Radio. Thanks for being here, Laura.
You're welcome.
And I want to start with you. Can you tell us exactly what Apple is being asked to do? Because I feel like there's been some confusion around this.
Well, it is confusing. I will say as to what they're being asked to do and what its implications are isn't 100% clear. But essentially, the government is saying on the iPhone, if you – and they actually don't know whether it's turned on or off on this particular phone, but – 10 tries of a password, and it just erases everything that's on the phone. So the government is asking Apple to basically circumvent the password on this phone, get into the phone, and allow them to look at what's on the phone and not have to worry about it getting erased if they use a brute force technique, i.e. keep trying passwords. You can't do that. So Apple is being asked to essentially build a kind of software that would break their own encryption. And this is the part, I think, where it gets a little controversial, and this is why I say I see a little disagreement in the security community. Apple is saying that if we build this key for this phone, this software, this key could be used in millions of other phones once we do that. Not because Apple's going to release it to the world, but because once you build something like that, you know, three engineers work on it. Who knows? You know, I mean, it's amazing how you can get information like that. So Apple is saying we don't even want to build this thing. And government, excuse me, you shouldn't be asking us, a private company, to do this. You have no right to do this. The controversy as to whether or not that's really true, whether or not they could actually build something for this individual phone. I'm sure Nate will probably disagree with the assessment. You know, and say that it, once they build it, it could be used for millions of phones. But I have talked to some security experts who say, yes, just this one phone. You can do this on just this one phone.
Well, Nate Cardozo with EFF, you say Apple is in the right here to refuse the court order or to refuse the government's request.
Absolutely. And actually, Laura, I do agree with you that Apple could build a software package that would work on only a single phone. The issue is the technique that they use to do it is general. And once a master key is created, that'll open the floodgates.
How is the technique general if it can only be used on one phone?
So the way it works is the software that Apple has been asked to write would work on any phone. However, it would have to be individually digitally signed using Apple's private key for each individual phone. So the software package itself is general, but it's signed individually to each particular device.
And the generation of this device, the 5C, is an issue here. Why is it an issue, Laura Seidel?
Well, because at least I have heard many people say that the latter phones are different from the 5C. Each edition of the Apple phone has been getting more secure. So some people are saying, we're just talking about the 5C. And so just do it for this one, and it may not even work on later phones.
So the technique couldn't be used to undermine, say, the generation 6 or beyond.
That is what some experts say.
And Benjamin Wittes, you believe that Apple should create the software necessary to help the feds. Tell us why.
Well, so I actually would start at a different place than that question. The federal government has been arguing with increasing anxiety over the last year and a half that the changes that Apple and other companies have made to its default settings on devices are really creating problems for law enforcement and the intelligence community. This is not limited to the San Bernardino phone at issue in this case. For example, FBI Director Comey last week in congressional testimony talked about a woman who had been murdered 8 months pregnant in Louisiana, and the only lead they have on her killing is her phone, which they cannot get into. And so I think there is a larger question here, and the larger question is, what civic obligation does a company like Apple that produces devices and communications equipment for mass use and laudably wants to make those devices as secure as possible for their users, what civic obligation do they have to assist technically in investigations where those users are either victims or witnesses or perpetrators? And I think Apple's position, which has been, we essentially have no obligations ever to help you decrypt our materials or help you bypass our encryption, and we will oppose any legislative or regulatory effort to force us to do that, has put the government in the position where, confronted with a dead body or 14 dead bodies and a phone, they have to rely on some creative legal argumentation to do their basic jobs. And I think, you know, outside the intellectual bubble of Silicon Valley, I think Apple's statement is, which is, you know, belligerently kind of pitchforks and torches, objection to the idea that they should ever have to help the government hack one of their devices, is going to play really, really badly for them.
Interesting. Well, I want to put that point to Nate Cardozo. I mean, you are in Apple's camp here. You think that they should not create this software. Is there ever an exception in your view, Nate? I mean, the magnitude of this crime, would that constitute an exception?
Well, this isn't a slippery slope. This is a cliff. And if Apple can be forced to create an entirely new piece of software, to digitally sign it and to give it to the FBI, or at least to give the fruits of it to the FBI, there's no limiting principle here. You know, Benjamin said that Apple is laboring under the impression that there is no obligation to assist law enforcement. And that's, of course, hogwash. Apple assists law enforcement every day, all the time. And they assisted law enforcement to an amazing extent in the San Bernardino case. The metadata, who the shooters were messaging, who they were talking to, where they were, all of that information is information that Apple has already turned over. So to say that Apple is not assisting law enforcement is patently false in this case.
Laura Seidel, I think this brings up some technological questions that have been on a lot of people's minds. So, you know, we have this cloud, right?
Yes.
And it has a lot of the information that's on our phone. So are they saying that there is information that exists only on this phone that it can't access?
Yes, they are. And I will say that it is true that Apple has been cooperating in many ways and has in the past with the government. And they've drawn a line in the sand at going this far. I will also say it probably isn't entirely unprecedented to ask a private company to do something like this, though the companies I'm talking about are more quasi-private, which is the phone companies. You know, were told by the government to create a backdoor so that the government could come with a warrant. Now, everybody needs to understand that we're talking about situations where there is a legal process we have in place. You can search somebody's home, but you need to prove to a judge first. But technologically speaking, I think part of what's going on here, though, is I think Apple is drawing a line in the sand here because we're living in a world in which everything we do, everything is being tracked. Where on earth can you find a little bit of privacy? Can you do something where the government can't get in when we have technology everywhere? We're putting, you know, things in our home to run our heating systems. That'll be trackable. That'll be put up in the cloud. So I think partially that's what's going on in this case. So technologically speaking, Apple also could ultimately, and I think Apple wants to come up with a phone that you cannot get into, that they don't have the key and they don't even know how to get into. And they are actually working on that. I also want to say just this is – Apple is staking this out, I think, as a business principle mm-hmm. as well at a time when I think people feel that where is my zone of privacy on this earth? And Apple wants to say it's – we will make sure your iPhone, which carries – is not just a phone. I mean that's what's different about perhaps those past instances we were talking about, a backdoor into the phone company. You're talking about phone conversations. This thing – I mean, I'm already a cyborg, you know. I am so attached to this thing. It has so much of my life. So Apple's drawing a line in the sand and saying, this far we're not going to go. We want to wash our hands of it.
Okay, so Laura, the Apple will make this, you know, undecryptable phone sometime down the line.
But they
this particular right, that's their goal, right?
Yeah.
But this particular phone, couldn't the FBI create something to get into the phone? It does sound unbelievable to some people that it's sitting there with this phone that it just cannot seem to get into.
That's, again, debatable. The government, of course, probably has some pretty awesome hackers working for them. I think it may be a question of how much time they're going to spend doing that. You know, probably they do have people who could come up with something, but it'll be a lot faster for Apple, which knows its systems, to do it than it will be for the feds. It's sort of like saying if Brinks had a safe and it was such a strong safe that it was going to take the government and there was a ticking – the government was worried there was a ticking time bomb in the safe. They might go to Brinks and say, give us the key.
Nate Cardozo, on a similar point, if Apple is making their phones more secure down the line, wouldn't what they create for this particular phone become obsolete at some point very soon in the future?
That's certainly possible. But as Laura said, this is where Apple's drawing a line in the sand. But it's not just that. This is where the FBI is drawing the line in the sand. I work for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We're an impact litigation organization. We take cases where we think we can change the law for the better or keep the law from getting worse. The FBI is using this case as impact litigation. This case is where the FBI is drawing the line in the sand to say, you, Silicon Valley, can't build these things that we can't get into. Remember, this particular phone isn't actually important to the investigation from everything we can tell. The shooters destroyed their personal phones. This is the work phone that, you know, it would shock me if the shooters destroyed their personal phones but somehow left all of the incriminating evidence on their work phone, which they didn't destroy. This case, you know, the FBI chose to litigate this case in public. It could be under seal. This is impact litigation for the FBI, and the FBI wants a rule here.
And you feel like that undermines their argument, the fact that they chose the most, I don't know, provocative case?
Well, I think it makes their argument more sympathetic to the American people, but it makes it less this isn't a ticking time bomb, right? This is the FBI cherry-picking a set of facts, which is very sympathetic. But this phone isn't actually important. What the FBI wants is a rule to say, hey, Silicon Valley, if you build something that we can't break into, we're going to take you to court and we're going to force you to spend who knows how much money, time, effort, and loss of goodwill in order to undermine that product. And that's what this case is about. It's not about this phone. It's about the precedent going forward.
Benjamin Wittes, do you agree? Is that what the FBI is after, really, ultimately?
Oh, I disagree with that almost completely. So let's start with I just want to correct something that Nate said earlier. I did not say that the FBI that Apple has refused all help. What I said was that the Apple has refused help in cracking encryption or in circumventing or hacking its devices. And I think that's an important, very important distinction. Now, look, As to what's motivating the FBI here, it is very easy for EFF to describe in an investigation in which it is not taking part what devices are and are not important. That is not the way the FBI conducts counterterrorism investigations or, for that matter, criminal law enforcement investigations. When somebody shoots 14 people, the devices that they use are by definition are important. The contacts that they have are by definition important. And for the FBI not to collect all available information that it's entitled to get under the law is malpractice. And it would be a shocking, shocking thing if in a major counterterrorism or, for that matter, mass shooting investigation, the FBI took the position regarding a device in use by the shooter that, you know, we think we're entitled to this material as a matter of law, but to keep Apple happy and to keep Nate Cardozo and EFF happy, we're going to sort of not pursue material that we think we're entitled to. That's not the way the FBI should work. It's not the way the FBI does work. So is this an attempt to affect the law? Sure, insofar as whenever you ask for something that there's an open legal question as to whether you're entitled to get, you obviously hope that you win and that that precedent becomes useful in the future in clarifying what people's legal obligations are. But I think it's a very it's a very naive way to think about the way the FBI conducts these investigations to say that this phone is unimportant and this is merely a publicity stunt.
Benjamin Wittes is Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution. We're also joined by Nate Cardozo, an attorney for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and Laura Seidel. She's Digital Cultural Correspondent for National Public Radio. Lisa tweets, "The iPhone is not personal property. It belongs to the County of San Bernardino. This is not a personal privacy issue. One of my high school friends was severely injured in the attack. If the county wants the iPhone opened, Apple should help." So, Nate Cardozo, what about the fact that the county owned the phone, not necessarily the shooter, and the county is saying you have our permission to access the information on it?
So that actually goes to the Fourth Amendment interests involved here. It doesn't go to Apple's Apple's right to produce a device that is that can't be broken into. I totally agree there that this device, there's a valid warrant for it. The county has consented. The owner of the device has consented to the search. The issue is whether Apple can be compelled to subvert its own security infrastructure. And the answer is no, from a legal standpoint and from a policy standpoint. Apple should not, and Silicon Valley companies should not, endanger all of our security by building in the law enforcement backdoors that the FBI wants.
You talk about the Fourth Amendment. Let's dissect a little bit the legal arguments that can compel companies to do this. So what's the All Writs Act, Benjamin Wittes?
Oh, so the All Writs Act is a very old law that allows companies allows the government to or allows a court to issue an order to enforce its own writs, its own orders. And so in the absence of so here you have a court order that says, Apple the government is entitled to search this phone, right? You have that warrant, and the question is, how does a court effectuate that warrant? And the All Writs Act says a court can issue whatever orders are necessary to effectuate its own lawful orders, its own lawful writs. So the government says, okay. That includes, and the Supreme Court in the 70s agreed with this in an admittedly different context, that allows a court to say to Apple, you must provide the government a certain amount of technical assistance. And so the legal question in this case, and I think Nate and I could probably even agree on the legal question, though I'll let him describe whether he agrees with me, is whether this technical assistance that the government is requesting constitutes an undue burden for Apple to give, or whether it constitutes a sort of reasonable request that the All Writs Act allows the government
to
request.
And I think Nate Cardozo agrees with your analysis. He's nodding here. But Laura Seidel, what kind of argument could Apple make under the law?
Well, you know what's kind of weird about this case, and I had a little piece on this morning about this, which is that I don't think we really have easy parallels to this situation. Because say there was a Brinks safe, and maybe we don't know. I will say as to what's on that phone, we don't know. We don't know if there's information that could lead to information about another attack. We really have no idea what's on the phone. And so say Brinks had a safe and the owner said, I want you to break into it. I've lost the key. Chances are good Brinks would do it. Could be perhaps compelled to do it under a court order in such a situation. What makes this case different is that Apple is saying, if we build this, we will make millions more phones insecure. Now, there is not an easy parallel for a situation like this. I think we're...
So just the global reach of Apple.
The global reach of Apple, the changing technology, the fact that, you know, computer technology and code can be duplicated, you know, ad nauseum. We're not talking about one key, right? It's almost as if maybe you were asking manufacturers to build doors that had a master key and everybody had to, you know, millions of people had to have that one door. But that doesn't happen. And I think the law is kind of struggling with that aspect of this case.
And just
Benjamin Wittes?
Just to be clear, I do think there's some reason to be skeptical of Apple's claim that the heavens will fall in cybersecurity terms if they have to build this. But I don't think the analogy that you've drawn to Brinks is all that far off. Because, look, if Brinks were to receive a technical assistance request under the All Writs Act to help the government crack one of its safes, it would probably do some of that work on computers that are connected to the internet. And it would have the same risk of the process that it used leaking out that Apple does. And we would say to Brinks, you managed to protect your trade secrets. You managed to protect your confidential business information. You can do this in a sealed room if you need to. You can destroy the code that you're writing as soon as it's used. And you've managed to produce safe after safe without the designs leaking out. Maybe you can produce some information about how to break one of those safes without the information leaking out. And we would consider that on the company's shoulders.
Benjamin Wittes, Senior Fellow in Governance Studies. We're also talking with Nate Cardozo, attorney for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and Laura Seidel with NPR. Do you agree with Apple, or do you think private companies should have to help decrypt phones in the event of a crime? Give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum at kqed.org or post them on our website or on Facebook. Our website is kqed.org/forum. I'm Mina Kim. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking about the showdown between Apple and the federal government over unlocking the iPhone of one of the San Bernardino killers. We're talking with Laura Seidel, digital culture correspondent for National Public Radio, Nate Cardozo, an attorney for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and Benjamin Wittes, senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. I asked our listeners to weigh in on this, and Errol writes, the truth is that the NSA has more than enough manpower and computing power to decrypt any Apple phone. The feds are playing a dangerous and reckless game of chicken with Apple and the rest of high tech that puts everyone's privacy at risk. If taken to its conclusion, it could result in these companies moving their headquarters overseas to some country that still respects freedom. And let me go to some phone calls. We've got a lot of folks who want to weigh in here. Let's go to Judy in San Francisco. Hi, Judy.
Hi. My husband works for Apple, and I know firsthand how hard they have to work to protect your data and how much harder it makes their jobs. But my main point is that if they make a backdoor, hackers are going to use that backdoor. People have already made that point, but nobody's made a point of national security on Apple giving away this backdoor. If that backdoor exists, hackers can use that to look at government agents. There, you know, if anyone works in any capacity in the government, in defense, and has an iPhone, that backdoor can be used that way to get at personal information about these people, where they're going to be. And so attacks can happen that way. And well, that's not something I've heard mentioned.
Well, Judy, thanks for the point. I think underscoring a lot of this, Laura Seidel and Nate Cardozo and Benjamin Wittes, I want to hear your thoughts on this, is that Apple has a lot of power in this situation to some degree, right? I mean, if we're not trusting the government with the information that they have, we're certainly trusting Apple to hang on to it and keep it secure. I mean, knowing that they have potentially the capacity, I don't think it's totally that people disagree that Apple has the capacity to build something that could circumvent their security features now. We are essentially saying we trust you with our personal information and we trust you to always keep it private. Is that a comfortable place for you to be, that a private company has that much power, Nate Cardozo?
Well, I don't think we have a choice. You know, we live online these days. All of our social interactions, all of our career, our work interactions, all of our romantic interactions, they all are mediated by these digital devices. But I think the caller had a very good point here. If Apple builds this one time for one phone for the FBI, we can be assured it's a guarantee that not only the FBI but other governments around the world are going to be demanding exactly the same access. Apple has so far been able to resist demands from Russia, from China, from Brazil for exactly this kind of access because they don't give it to the United States government. Once they give it to the FBI, that's it. They will be unable to resist demands from regimes around the world who have far fewer due process or human rights protections.
Benjamin Wittes, what do you think about that? If Apple does this for the U.S., it no longer can say that it doesn't do this for any government.
So first of all, I think exactly what Apple's relationship is with the authoritarian governments in the countries that the authoritarian countries in which it has major business operations is a matter of some opacity, to be honest. That said, I don't believe that the Politburo of the Communist Party of China or Vladimir Putin is waiting with bated breath to hear how the Central District of California District Judge in the Ninth Circuit or the U.S. Supreme Court interprets the All Writs Act. The day they want to force Apple, and may have already happened, may not have already happened, the day they want to force Apple to produce material, they will do it. And nothing about the rule of law discussion in the United States will encumber that decision. I will say on the caller's question, I think, look, there is no doubt, and those of us who argue for a less binary approach on Apple's part to this problem, I would never argue that there are not significant cybersecurity costs to building, if you call it backdoor or extraordinary access or some, anytime you build a hole in something or you burrow in, there is the chance of that being leaking out or replicating or you know, merely the demonstration that it can be done constitutes an invitation to people to try. My point is simply that individual privacy and cybersecurity are, though extremely important values, are not the only important security values, including the only individual security values. And for the woman who's dead in Louisiana, whose phone settings are such that, her case cannot be investigated, there is a huge privacy interest and other interest on the part of her family in having somebody have access to that material so that maybe you can find out who her killer is. And so I accept that the point that I'm arguing may have some cybersecurity implications, and I want to be candid about that. The question is but cybersecurity and individual privacy associated with cybersecurity are not the only goods we have to maximize in a complex society.
Laura Seidel, how much has the NSA revelations from Edward Snowden hurt the government's ability to get you know, the public on its side in this case. We had a Twitter poll that looked at whether or not how many people supported Apple's, you know, refusal versus not, and a vast majority supported Apple's position on this.
Yeah, I'm getting that from you know, various places myself, although I haven't – none of these are real polls, so
right,
I don't know.
Very unscientific.
And very unscientific, and anything in the Bay Area is probably going to be more sympathetic, mm-hmm. whereas in the rest of the country, people may see it very differently. But I think in this particular situation, you know, Apple is in a very complicated position in this particular situation. I think that it's trying to say there's a principle at stake here, and it's drawing a line in the sand that as a free society, sometimes we don't do certain things, even though it might be more expedient. Law enforcement has to go through very careful procedures before it's able to get information, and Apple's drawing a line in the sand. I did want to bring up, too, though, that I think Apple, the point that this is a business decision for Apple as well.
Right. I mean, what I mean by the Snowden revelations is that after that, tech companies
yes.
were like, you know what? We don't give anything to
exactly.
the government. We make it extremely hard for
and
them
I
to
think
access
that's
anything.
Where that's where the public sentiment around this shifted. And I think when the public began to see that tech companies, you know, were cooperating in any way with the government to give massive amounts of information to the government, a lot of the tech companies started to see that the public was very uncomfortable with this. And so I think there the Snowden revelations, Apple is coming out and it's saying, we're not going to do that. You guys can trust us. And so I think the Snowden revelations had a huge impact on Apple and all of the tech companies in that just they want the public to trust them.
Yeah, they've almost staked their corporate reputations on it, right?
Yes,
sense that they will protect.
Apple certainly is.
Yes.
More than any other company, I think Apple is.
And let's go to more calls. Let's go to Matthew in San Jose. Hi, Matthew.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm well, thanks. Go ahead.
Great. Yeah, I guess the safe analogy didn't really match up in my mind. I wanted to comment on that physical security like that, you can always cut the back off a safe, but software, it doesn't work that way. Mm. What's being asked of Apple is not, you know, open up the phone and take it out. They've created something that's encrypted that's supposed to be secure and safe, even to Apple. So if they're being asked by the government to go in and extract the data from this phone, either there's already a vulnerability there that not just Apple, but any hacker, anyone not good could break into, or their software really is secure and they don't have an option to get into it.
So then
being put in a really tough place.
So Matthew, where do you fall on this then?
I think that Apple, you know, they have to comply with the law if they're required to, but I don't think that they're able to. If they're able to, there's a problem with the way they've marketed their phones as being safe and secure. Well, if Apple's able to get in, anyone can get in. It's not just them. It's not a key that only Apple has. Anyone would be able to work their way into it.
But Nate Cardozo, do you believe Apple cannot do this?
So we're pretty certain that Apple can do this. The specific technique that the FBI is proposing here actually does depend on a key that only Apple has, and that's the private key that signs code that runs on iPhones. And that actually is something that only Apple has right now.
Well, Matthew, thanks for the call. Let me take some more. Brad in San Francisco. Hi, Brad.
Hi. What I wanted to say is I think we've already been down this road with the Bush administration. Bush administration, you and the federal government use terrorism as an extraordinary circumstance to justify a whole bunch of measures against all of the things that stable democracies hang on, like personal privacy. And now I find it ironic that the FBI is using the same excuse and the same pretext to justify another measure against one of these hallmarks of democracy. What I think is at stake is that people are not seeing the government is slowly, and it's in the terrorist interest to see the government slowly descend into this sort of authoritarian police state point of view. And I think it's incredibly destructive. I don't think that Apple is necessarily, I'm not sure what is in their best interest, but it seems to me that privacy is an important measure to sustain and that we should be very careful about tampering with it just because there's one particular instance where it might seem like a terrorist plot might be, you know, uncovered.
Well, Brad, yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead and finish your thought. Well, Brad, I think we get the idea. But Benjamin Wittes, you've been giving the example so far of the pregnant woman who was killed and her phone was found by her side. But is there strong evidence that the government's inability to access encrypted data has really been hampering their investigations in a very substantive way that hurts national security?
Well, so it's a very difficult subject for the government to talk about. And frankly, the government has not yet done a wonderful job of talking publicly and highlighting the scope of the problem. And so I think one of the issues is we don't know how big the problem is. The government has for a long time said in broad sort of strokes that there's a problem here, that there's a bunch of cases that they are now encumbered from investigating, and that the problem is least acute in the intelligence context, most acute at the local law enforcement level. That is, the caller who pointed out that NSA has a lot of resources and a lot of capacity is right. The San Bernardino Police Department, maybe not so much, right? And so there's a part of the question is at what level of federal or state or local authority are you talking, and what capacities and what functions? There's a real difference between the intelligence community and the law enforcement community here. Now, the other important point is that for a while, people who are skeptical of the going dark problem have, quite rightly, in my view, say, show us the cases where this is a real problem if you want a policy solution to that problem. If you want to even talk about it, the burden is on you to start coming forward with cases where, you can't do things that we really expect you to do. And so I think part of what's going on now is that the FBI is trying to figure out how to talk about things that previously it may not have talked about. And I think both the Louisiana case and the San Bernardino cases are, efforts to try to answer that question. How many such cases are there? I think the answer is unclear at this point, honestly.
All right. Nate Cardozo?
Last fall, Cyrus Vance, the district attorney of New York County, which is Manhattan, released a white paper where he talked about this problem, the problem of encrypted smartphone storage. And at the time, he said it was 71, and now the number is up somewhere over 100, that his department had encountered 71 iPhones that they couldn't decrypt. Glaringly missing from the report, deafening by its silence, was any sort of mention that any of those iPhones had actually hampered an investigation, right? The metadata is not protected. The metadata, who called who, where they were, who they were emailing, who they were texting, who they were iMessaging, all of that data is available. And that's what police need to do their jobs. So yeah, Cyrus Vance has 71 iPhones sitting in a vault that he can't decrypt. But he hasn't said that any of those, not one, caused a problem with his investigation or kept his department from bringing charges in a single case.
And Nate Cardozo is with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Laura Seidel, what has the technology community's response been to this? It feels like it's been rather tepid, actually.
Well,
and when I say technology community, I mean other companies.
They have slowly but surely been coming out largely in support of Apple, but I guess tepid would be like they're not, screaming up and down. And I think some of it may have to do with the fact that many of the companies already do have some kind of relationship with the federal government, and they're wary of, really jumping too heavily on this bandwagon really loudly. They already do – many of them have contracts with the federal government. Historically speaking, the tech sector has always had jobs from the federal government. I mean, the first silicon chips were sold to NASA. So I think that's part of it, why they're supporting it, but not maybe jumping up and down. But I think overall, the sentiment is on Apple's side.
Well, let's go to Michael in Oakland. Hi, Michael.
Hi. I think there's just a piece of this that hasn't been discussed, which is that Apple has already created
I'm sorry, Michael. Michael, are you there? I think we'll have to try Michael back in a second when he has a better line. A listener writes, I wonder why this issue is even being discussed in public. Why can't Apple and the FBI have dealt with this issue very secretly and privately and not have this had to become a publicly discussed issue that's only made it more difficult to resolve for both the FBI and Apple? I thought I read somewhere, Laura Seidel, that there was some consternation on Apple's side that this became more public than they wanted it to be and that they're responding publicly.
They're responding publicly. And I, you know, I had not read that. I will say this. I think Tim Cook wants to start a conversation.
I do, too.
And I think they tried very hard for a very long time to resolve this. And if that's what you're referring to, I don't think they wanted to go public. But when it reached this point, I think Tim Cook made the decision, okay, it's time. We need to talk about this. And I think from that perspective, the fact that we're on this show talking about this issue and what we should do as a society and how we should think about it is exactly what Tim Cook was hoping would happen.
But Nate Cardozo, is it true? I mean, am I remembering that report correctly?
I read the same thing. I read that Apple wanted to have this litigation sealed, and it was the FBI's choice to bring it public. And that makes sense from the FBI's perspective. As I said earlier, the FBI is treating this as impact litigation. And the FBI has set it up in a way that it at least believes that it can't lose. And here's what I mean by that. If FBI loses this motion in the Central District of California, and let's say they lose at the Ninth Circuit as well, what they're going to do is have ammunition to go to Congress and say, look, the law as it exists didn't allow us to demand a backdoor. We already know that in both House and Senate intelligence committees, there is a backdoor bill that's being circulated. We haven't seen a draft of it yet. We have significant concerns about its constitutionality. But if FBI loses this case, they're going to take it to Congress.
All right, Benjamin Wittes, then, in governance studies at the Brookings Institution, could this initiate legislation in Congress, and what would the chances be for it to pass? I mean, we've had both Republicans and Democrats criticizing Apple's stance. Dianne Feinstein came out against Apple, though I should note that Mike Honda and Zoe Lofgren recently came out in support of Apple. What are the chances that legislation could come out of this?
Well, so I think anytime you're asking about what are the chances of legislation on any subject, given the current state of congressional dysfunction, you have to handicap that outcome as very low. You know, when Director Comey first raised this subject, he raised it as he wanted to start a conversation. He didn't know what he thought the right answer was, and he wanted, you know, a public discussion about it. And that has happened over the last couple of years. And I think that legislation, in the absence of presidential endorsement and a request for legislation from the president is and the administration is probably unlikely.
Okay, that said, so forget the chances question. Why don't you tell me what you think the legislation would look like for folks who want Apple to give up this information? What would it say?
I mean, so there's a few possible ways that Congress could go. One would be a simple regulatory mandate along the lines of what the telecommunications service providers are required to do, which is, you know, which the internet which does not cover the internet companies, and the simply, you know, a simple regulatory requirement that you have to be able to produce decrypted content in response to a warrant to do so. Another possibility, which actually I have sort of flirted with in some of my writings, is that you could make some of the amazing immunities that the internet companies have been given by Congress contingent on the ability to do this. And then a third possibility would be a sort of pure carrots approach, you know, that that, you know, you can these are companies that want a lot of things from the federal government. And, you know, you could imagine Congress sort of saying, if you want these things, you know, don't put us in the position where we can't do the highest stakes investigations.
Well, Michael in Oakland, he tried to call us earlier. He ended up emailing us and he says, I found out from your program that the phone in question belongs to the county. As someone who has configured hundreds of iPads for K-12 schools, I can say Apple has already created tools to unlock iOS devices. I have ways to unlock a student's iPad if they forget the password. It seems to me that this is a massive failure on the part of the county to properly set up their devices. Nate Cardozo.
No doubt. You know, that's called mobile device management software. It's very common. And San Bernardino simply didn't have it installed.
Michael, but, thanks for the point.
To respond to something that Benjamin just said, it's important to remember that any sort of mandate that comes out of Congress or that comes out of the court in the Central District of L.A. Is going to be totally ineffective. All you have to do right now in order to make your device unbreakable is download an app from the App Store. Even if Apple puts in a backdoor, that the real bad guys, the people that we really care about, terrorists, pedophiles, organized crime, they're going to find a way to lock down their devices. And that's as simple as going to the App Store. So any backdoor along the lines that I think Benjamin is advocating for is going to only affect law-abiding Americans. And it's not going to affect terrorists and the people that we really should be worried about.
Well, let's go to Nick in San Francisco. Nick, go ahead.
Yeah, there's a different legal angle I'd like the panel's perspective on. The analogy has been made, like, if this is Brinks, court could order them to open it. Brinks would just get a drill and drill the lot. This isn't that. Courts essentially ordered a private enterprise to create an entirely new piece of software. We don't know how long that's going to take. We don't know how many engineers that's going to require. It's probably only a few people, but what if this were a smaller tech company where three engineers in a room for a month might actually bankrupt the company? Is there legal precedent on this issue? And just what's the panel's opinion on a court ordering a private enterprise to create something entirely new?
Well, that's the crux of the question, right? Laura Seidel. Thanks, Nick.
I would agree that this is a rather unprecedented situation, and it is one brought about in the digital age in terms of the law, because we've never seen anything quite like it. Because you're right, a safe you could probably crack open without the help of Brinks. But the best analogy probably would be the phone companies, where they were required to put in the ability into their equipment for the government to tap wires. The difference is that Apple is a truly private company, whereas the phone companies, you know, were sort of quasi-monopolies granted certain rights by the government. So in that way, this is not a parallel. But you can see where they did force a private company to do something like this before.
All right. Let's go to more calls. Again, that number is 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. And our website is kqed.org/forum. And our email is forum@kqed.org. Benjamin Wittes, was that you?
Yeah, I just wanted to add in response to the caller's question that I do think the standard that of an undue burden might be very different if you're talking about a small company that could make a reasonable argument. Hey, actually, we don't have the resources to get this done without bankrupting us. I would think that would be a much more substantial argument that Apple is going to than Apple has been made in the past in situations like this, and will be able to make in this case that there's
it's
a resource
constraint.
It's definitely
not going to bankrupt Apple.
Exactly. When you have $100 billion on hand, you know, putting a few engineers to work on a problem like this, like Apple has some good arguments about whether this may be an undue burden, but I don't think the resources are one. On the other hand, for a tiny little startup, I think that argument might be very powerful.
Yeah. Well, Julian in New Orleans. Hi, Julian.
Hi. There's one thing about all this that kind of mystifies me and makes me really uncomfortable, which is the willingness of people in this argument to come down completely on one side or the other, as if we're not obviously in a situation in a world where we need to balance security and privacy. I mean, I don't know exactly what the solution to this problem is, but I do know that it's going to involve the two sides hammering out a compromise that doesn't come down all the way on devices that are completely impossible to unlock. Or, you know, something where the government just has, you know, we all have open doors to let the government in wherever we want. I mean, they need to figure it out. Most people that are participating in this that are Joe Public, we don't have the nuanced technical knowledge to know the solution, but there needs to be a compromise, period.
Well, Julian, and I think that's basically what this question, this program is sort of getting at in terms of how do you resolve this situation? And I want to ask you, Nate Cardozo, you've mentioned the process, you know, in terms of what's next is that Tim Cook will likely appeal the order and then a ruling will come in weeks, I assume, and then it'll probably go through an appeals process. How soon could this be resolved? Folks seem pretty cynical about any legislation coming through. So how soon could the court case be resolved?
Well, as a litigator, I'm not going to make any predictions like that. So the process is right
now. Okay, what about the odds it'll go to the Supreme Court?
Very, very slim. The odds are very slim that it'll go to the Supreme Court.
Why?
Well, right now it's before a federal magistrate judge, which is the lowest level of federal court. From there, it'll be appealed to the district court, and from there, it'll be appealed to the Ninth Circuit. The only scenario where I see this going to the Supreme Court is if the government loses big time at the Ninth Circuit. If the government wins at the Ninth Circuit, Supreme Court's not going to take the case. So that's it. But there's another legal argument which we haven't touched on today, which is First Amendment right against compelled speech. Apple has a right not to be compelled to speak in a way that is untrue and against its interests. And that's going to be core to its argument here.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what argument Apple makes when it files its brief. Nate Cardozo with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
Thanks also Benjamin Wittes, Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution, and he co-directs the Harvard Law School Brookings Project on Law and Security. Thanks, Benjamin Wittes.
Thank you.
Thanks also to you, Laura Seidel, the digital cultural correspondent for National Public Radio.
You're welcome.
And thanks to our listeners for your questions and comments. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with help from Jeremy Siegel. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our executive producer is Joanne Wallace. I'm Mina Kim. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.